Benzodiazepines, America's other drug problem. The class of drugs called benzodiazepines, better known by names such as Valium and Xanax, have been used for years to treat anxiety, insomnia, and seizure disorders. Benzos, as they're also called, are coming under scrutiny for their addictive properties and for contributing to the nation's overdose crisis, particularly when used in combination with opioids. I'm Keith Shortall. Today, we'll learn more about how benzodiazepines work and some of the different viewpoints on when these drugs should or should not be used. We'll also explore the latest information on the risks that benzodiazepines present, particularly to pregnant women, older patients, and people who are using opioids or other drugs. What you should know about benzodiazepines. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Benzodiazepines, also referred to as benzos, are psychoactive drugs commonly prescribed to treat anxiety and sleep disorders. The use of these drugs is on the rise, raising questions about their benefits and risks. Joining me in our Portland studio to talk about benzodiazepines are Dr. Allison Malloy, founder of Portland Cognitive and Behavioral Neurology, specializing in cognitive, behavioral, neurologic, and psychiatric disorders, and Dr. Jonathan Fellers, an addiction psychiatrist at Maine Medical Center. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about benzodiazepines? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, both of you, to Maine Calling. We'll start, I guess, with the basic question, Dr. Allison Malloy. What are benzodiazepines, this class of medications?
Benzodiazepine is a GABA receptor activator, and GABA is the primary inhibitory neurotransmitter in the brain. So if you increase your GABA, you increase the inhibition of the brain, and benzodiazepines are thought to work primarily in the amygdala to reduce the fear response, and also they work in the cortex to reduce seizure activity.
And you say they're thought to, but I had read in preparing for this, like, there's some suggestion that we may not completely understand how they work.
That's true for most medications, I would say. We have a good idea of some of the mechanisms, but much of what we use is unknown.
Yeah. Dr. Jonathan Fellers, then, what do we use these for?
Well, as inhibitors or kind of sedating medications, we use them for disorders that could benefit from more, I guess, depressant effects on the central nervous system. So a lot of anxiety disorders are mainly, we would prescribe benzodiazepines for them. So panic disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, and specific phobias. Like if someone has a fear of flying, for example, and they get terrified of doing that, they might take a benzodiazepine right before doing so, so they don't have that panic reaction and are able to get through it. And we also use them to help with sleep for the short-term management of insomnia. And they are prescribed also for seizure disorders. That's less common, though.
So, and as we said at the top, they have been prescribed in increasing amounts. There are various statistics, but since, in the last 10 years, it appears as the prescription rates have increased. Is there concern about that with respect to the prescribing rates and also the potential for addiction?
Yeah, I mean, I've been practicing medicine for about 15 years. And early on in my career, I had a mentor. I ran a case by him of this very complicated patient who was already prescribed benzos. And I was very concerned about the situation. I was concerned about taking the patient on. And my mentor said, yeah, I just don't prescribe them. And I said, what? Really? You can just not prescribe them? And he said, yeah, I've had a very successful career with not using that class of medications at all. And so that really got me thinking long and hard about what is a class of medications that I needed to use in my toolbox. And I can say that I myself have had a very successful career in very rarely prescribing benzodiazepines. So in my practice, I have a concern about the overuse of it because I get a lot of patients who are already on them and it has created problems for them. I know that the incidence of depression and anxiety is at epidemic levels right now. And so primary care physicians, with the crunch of time, where they're given a 15-minute appointment with a patient based on, you know, insurance compensation and various other productivity measures, it's not enough time to really dig into the etiology of a patient's depression and anxiety. So, you know, our beloved primary care physicians are stuck with getting a rapid solution. And benzodiazepine could be a very rapid solution for anxiety.
And I'll just follow up. You said that some of these patients who are on them that you're seeing are having problems with them.
Yes.
What is that describing? That they're not doing what they used to do? Can they actually have the reverse act over time?
Well, many patients never had an informed consent conversation with the prescriber when the medication was given to them, with the physician or nurse practitioner or physician assistant saying, hey, these medications can be addictive. So many people end up on the medications, and then all of a sudden they're dependent, physiologically dependent on the meds, and they try to take it, and then they have withdrawal, and they end up in a vicious loop. And the person is saying, you know, I never wanted to be stuck on a medication. So then they need to get off.
Yeah. Jonathan Fellers, you would say that there are legitimate and very helpful times when these drugs should be appropriately used.
Yeah, they're really good for the short-term management of severe anxiety and stress responses. But that's really where the trick here is. Like, doing something acutely versus doing something chronically lead to very different outcomes and risk benefit ratios for the management. So a good example would be for the treatment or management of insomnia. They're really effective for about 2 weeks, and then they stop losing their effectiveness and people develop tolerance to them, and they no longer will induce the sleep response, and people will have to escalate the dose over time, and then they're not able to sleep at all without them. So they're really discouraged to use for sleep in particular. And for anxiety disorders, you see a very similar type response, that they're very effective for the acute management of anxiety reactions, but staying on the medication over time, people develop tolerance to them. And one of the diagnoses I see a lot is benzodiazepine dependence with benzodiazepine-induced anxiety disorder, meaning over time, the tolerance to the benzodiazepine, people will develop withdrawal symptoms when they don't take it and have worse anxiety than the anxiety we initially tried to treat with it.
Is this because the brain is trying to respond to this and so reacts to the drug and interferes with how the normal brain was sort of deal with anxiety?
Yeah, that's a great – so our bodies really, you know, in third grade I learned this, that like homeostasis, everybody has heard that our bodies like to stay in homeostasis, stay even. Like, you don't want to be too hot, that would be a fever. You don't want to be too cold, that would be hypothermia and frostbite. And we like it just like Goldilocks, right in the middle. And when you take a benzodiazepine, it kind of puts us off balance. We're no longer in that perfect middle ground, and it puts us to a more depressed state of our central nervous system. And so as a consequence, we develop tolerance, or counter pathways are recruited in the brain to counteract the sedating effect of the medication. That's a natural response. It's what it's the basis of homeostasis. And so over time, the medication is no longer effective because these other counter pathways have been recruited, and you don't get the same effect. And then if you take the substance away, you will experience a characteristic withdrawal syndrome, which is the exact opposite of its acute effect.
And then you've got a new problem.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you want to add to that?
Yeah, just that we have receptors on the surface of our cells. And like Dr. Fellers was saying, you give a medication, the cells react in a certain way based on activation of the receptors. Over time, the body learns to withdraw some of the receptors if the level of the medication, let's say, is high, the body will pull back in, the cell will pull back in some of its receptors so that it's effectively less activated. And that's the basis of tolerance.
Now, the drugs, the names that we know are commonly Xanax, Valium, Ativan. What are some others?
Clonopin.
What are the differences between each of those? They're in the same class, but would you use different drugs for a different condition?
You can. So the main differences between them are their pharmacologic profile. So like what their half-life is or how long it takes for half of the drug to be metabolized by the body and so that only half is still remaining. So short-acting benzodiazepines, things like triazolam or Sonata, they're like, we really use those ones as hypnotic agents or things to help us sleep. Longer-acting agents like clonazepam or Librium or things like that, which stick around in the body for a long time, they're better for things that you need a constant level of a medication. And so seizure disorders, alcohol withdrawal, and then the long-term or chronic use in the treatment of anxiety, we usually recommend longer-acting medications. And then there's the middle ground, medications that are pretty effective but short-acting. And then Xanax in particular, alprazolam, seems to be slightly different than some of the other ones in that it's super potent and appears to have more ability to become addicted to. So people can develop pretty severe addiction to alprazolam compared to some of the other benzodiazepines and have quite severe withdrawal syndromes from it. So that seems to be kind of a unique, more potent, I'm talking about opioids all the time, but benzo relative to the others.
Well, we'll get to opioids too as well. And you mentioned alcohol. I want to get back to that. So like an appropriate, I was going to ask Allison, you said you very rarely would prescribe mm-hmm. this, but if someone were getting an MRI and was claustrophobic and had to be in a confined space and just couldn't do it, would that be a case?
Absolutely. I would prescribe a benzodiazepine for someone who has claustrophobia and is getting imaging, like Dr. Fellers mentioned before, someone who has a severe phobia of flying. I'll give them maybe two pills to get there and get back, maybe three in case they lose one. But also some other situations. For example, I had a patient who had essential tremor and a very severe essential tremor. He also was addicted to alcohol. He didn't want to do deep brain stimulation for treatment of the essential tremor. And one of the best medications for that is Micelin. So I did prescribe that for him. And it was a very difficult and awkward situation. But in that patient, in that situation, it actually was a really great treatment. His tremor went in remission. He actually, after I did do a Librium taper, and then after he was abstinent from alcohol and he participated in Alcoholics Anonymous and treated the tremor with Micelin, it really did help him stay sober and treat the tremor. Another situation is a patient who comes to me already on benzos. I have one patient now who I have been unable to taper her, partially because she doesn't tolerate any of the alternatives, and she's pretty well controlled on her current regimen. And I think it's a shared decision-making situation when you decide together on a treatment plan.
Both of you mentioned the use of these for alcohol withdrawal. Isn't there sort of a great risk, though, sending someone home with these, as we all know, like the likelihood of them possibly not being able to stay away from alcohol when they're in the privacy of their house, but having these drugs present, the combination can be really risky.
Right. The combination is very risky. And it's really important to counsel patients to avoid alcohol if you are prescribing benzodiazepines, which is one of the challenges of what I'd call ambulatory detox, which would be not in a place where you stay overnight and you can be monitored and you're in a controlled environment. So there's there's a lot less chance that you would be combining alcohol with the benzodiazepine. But ambulatory detox would be seeing someone, giving them a prescription, and then they could drink on the prescription after. And that can be very dangerous. In particular, some of the dangers that happen are really increased risk for very bad memory problems. So I have had patients who have been in what I'd call a blackout, which is having no memory of what has happened. And I've had people who've had that experience for over a day with the combination of benzodiazepines and alcohol. And then the risk of overdose and death is higher, too, because they are synergistic medications, meaning they both affect the respiratory drive center, but in slightly different manner. And so the additive effect of them actually increases the toxicity and the potential for death.
And we're all aware of the opioid crisis and also this fact that I think it's something like a quarter of opioid overdoses involve also a combination with benzodiazepine. Is that making the benzodiazepine argument that much more urgent now?
I mean, that's a good question. I think what's urgent is the mental health crisis in the United States right now. People are just freaking out. And they're looking for some escape from their suffering. And especially in Maine, we have a very difficult time providing adequate mental health care to people. And many people are not getting what they need. I take phone calls every day from patients looking for a psychiatrist. So when I hear that, I just think about someone who's in extraordinary pain and doesn't have access to the services that they need.
So you're saying it's as much a societal problem around whatever the sources of anxiety are as it is about these drugs that are out there and available.
I believe so. It's not just the societal problem. It's not just the medications. It's something we touched on earlier about access to the medications. You could look at it as a political problem of importation of drugs. You could also look at it as a prescribing problem of pharmaceutical industry misadvertising to physicians and withholding important information. And then physicians end up prescribing things that are potentially dangerous and they're not aware of it, which is what happened with opiates and in some cases is continuing to happen with benzos.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Lunder Foundation, founding partner of Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical.
On the next Fresh Air...
Oh, that looks beautiful from radio. It has a stark beauty all its own.
As the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing approaches, Charles Fishman talks about how much of the Apollo program was improvised, from hand-wired computers to spacesuits designed by Playtex. His new book is One Giant Leap. Join us.
Coming up tonight at 7 o'clock, here on Maine Public Radio. From coffee shops to car dealers, lawyers to landscapers, a wide variety of businesses and organizations throughout Maine support this service. They know the value of public radio and want to support it, and they want to reach you, the public radio audience. If your business or organization is interested in knowing more, please visit mainepublic.org and click on Support, and then Business Support, or call Susan Tran at 800-884-1717. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, the rise in use of benzodiazepines. My guests today are two experts in psychiatry. Dr. Jonathan Fellers is with Maine Medical Center. Dr. Allison Malloy is founder of Portland Cognitive and Behavioral Neurology. We invite you to join the conversation. The number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Will take a few calls in a moment. Allison, I wanted to ask you, so in the case of, say, alcohol withdrawal, what would you do instead of benzodiazepines? What are some of the alternatives to do these sort of transitionary treatments?
So in my work, to me, it comes down to the danger of the withdrawal. Some patients have a lot of personal experience where they know that when they stop drinking alcohol abruptly, they do not have delirium tremens, which can be life-threatening. So in that patient, they can say, okay, I know based on what I've been drinking now that I can just stop cold turkey and I'm going to be fine. So if that's the case, I try to do nothing from a medication standpoint. And my practice style, and you can interview 10 doctors and they would have different ones, but my practice style is to get them quickly into Alcoholics Anonymous and really have 24/7 support. And I myself see them quite frequently with very close follow-up to help provide support and education and to get them through. If the person starts to get nauseous or sweaty and they do have a very mild withdrawal history, I will do an outpatient detox myself because I think it's very helpful to withdraw in vivo in your home. So you don't have that transition state of being in a bubble and then having to come home and have your typical triggers. But if anybody has any serious medical comorbidities like sleep apnea, or if they have a history of serious withdrawal, or I just get the sense that they may be at a risk for taking too much of the benzos that I prescribe or any other situation like that, then they would need an inpatient detox.
What is the special danger caused by mixing benzodiazepine with opioids? Why do they come? Why is the combination so dangerous?
Well, it's very similar to why the combination of alcohol and benzos is dangerous, but it's slightly different. So opioids suppress respiratory rate, and benzodiazepines reduce the tidal volume, which is how deep of a breath you take. And so that synergistic effect is particularly potent in the sense that if the respiratory drive is reduced from taking the opioid, one is not needing to breathe as frequently. And then if the tidal volume is suppressed from the benzodiazepine at the same time, then those breaths that are taken just aren't deep enough to really deliver enough oxygen and provide ventilation of the carbon dioxide. And so they work through a different mechanism to really increase the risk of apnea and death.
Let's take a call. We'll go to Christy in Brunswick. Hi, Christy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Kay. Thank you. I just wanted to tell listeners, my 15-year-old son, Calvin, was prescribed his first benzodiazepine, Klonopin, when he was 3 years old for the seizures. And it took us to put him on another benzodiazepine or a derivative called Clobazam, the brand name Onfi, to get him off of that, because his seizures doubled when we started to reduce the Klonopin. And then he was on that for probably about 5 years before we understood that it was not maintaining its efficacy. We kept having to go up and up and up, and he ended up being on like an adult dose as a 40-pound child. And he also had paradoxical side effects from it. He had terrible insomnia, and he was extremely, extremely hyperactive, manic. And so we decided that anything would be better, even a seizure a day, if we didn't have to deal with the drug side effects. They were worse than the epilepsy itself. So it took us 4 years to get off of the Clobazam. And I luckily did it with the help of a manual called Ashton Manual, written by Heather Ashton, is a specialist on benzodiazepines and their withdrawal. And I hate to use a cliche, but neurologists pass out benzodiazepines like candy. And they're really only used for a short-term use, like 2 weeks, and yet children are on them for years. And they also contribute to what's called anterograde memory loss, which means the forming of new memories, which affects learning. Sure. And so there's a lot of really bad side effects that neurologists aren't telling their patients. And I know that they can be good for people whose children will respond to nothing else and they're having hundreds of seizures a day or a week. But they're really dangerous, and neurologists will take their patients off of them within a matter of weeks when really it should be taking like months, if not years.
Yeah, Christy, sure, I appreciate it. There's a lot in there, but I'll let our panelists respond. Jonathan, you want to go first? You were shaking your head in agreement throughout much of her comments.
Right, and that is the real danger that we're talking about, that the chronic use of them over time, they do lose their efficacy. They're really great short term, but the problem with something like a seizure disorder, which is a lifetime diagnosis and is going to require management over years, that means that the dose people will develop tachyphylaxis, which is the development of tolerance, and the dose will have to go up to now provide the same effect. And that can lead to very high doses. And then the side effects of the medications can really start coming out. Like the caller was talking about, that you can even have paradoxical things come out. So when I had mentioned that with anxiety disorders, with the treatment of chronic benzodiazepines, anxiety can actually worsen on benzodiazepines. It can worsen the symptom that you are actually trying to treat.
Is that because of as the dose gets higher, just the reaction of the particular patient?
Both. That we develop tolerance to certain aspects of medicines at different rates than other things, and so some things we don't develop tolerance at all to. So, like an example would be opiates. With opiates, we don't really develop tolerance to the constipating effect of them. And so people will always be constipated on opioids. However, you do develop tolerance to other effects of them. And so, like the caller was saying, her child developed tolerance to the anti-seizure properties of them, but not as good tolerance to the amnesia-inducing properties and some of the other things. And so you have the risk-benefit ratio when you look at these things really changes the longer you're on them, and also with a dose that you're taking.
Yeah.
one complicating factor here, and I am a board-certified neurologist in addition to a board-certified psychiatrist, and one of the challenges with pediatric neurology is that the FDA approval for medications. There's a lot of seizure medications, and many of them we don't quite understand exactly how they work. We know that they increase certain channels, usually chloride channels or sodium channels, and it helps depress the central nervous system. But there's also the problem of exposing your child to medications that have not been tested yet. And usually studies are not done on children. So we'll get a lot of seizure medications that are FDA approved for treating seizures in adults, but not in kids. So the pediatric neurologists like to use medications that have been around a very long time, that are relatively pure, that we know all the side effects. And I think that's why benzodiazepines are really a go-to med sometimes in pediatric epilepsy. Notwithstanding the problems of them, there's also some advantages.
Sure. Let's go to Wick in Berwick. Wick in Berwick. Hi, Wick. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Listen, I've been on Klonopin for 20 years daily. I started out with a half a milligram, stayed there for 5 years, went up to 1 milligram. I finally reached 2 milligrams, and I had a new doctor who took me off of it cold turkey. I didn't sleep for a week. I take it for insomnia. I'm back on it for the last 3 years. I went back on it 1 milligram, and I'm working my way down to a half milligram successfully. But the 20 years that I've been on benzodiazepines have been the most successful years of my life.
And that's because of helping you sleep, you mean?
Well, yeah, I've been able to sleep. Prior to the Klonopin, I used alcohol to get myself to sleep. And, of course, the side effects of alcohol in a functional daytime life are detrimental. It was very problematic for me. Clonazepam eliminated the need for alcohol. I could sleep at night. I could function during the day. I earned a bachelor's degree. I served in the Maine State Legislature for a number of years, things I never could have done if it wasn't for clonazepam. And so I hear all the horror stories about benzodiazepines. But my experience has been the complete opposite.
Interesting.
I think you raise a good point, and it's similar to a patient that I have now who we may get to hear from later in the show, who the meds are working fine for her. And she got a new doc and was going to be rapidly tapered, and she's like, hey, you know, that's going to be a problem. And so I think the pendulum has swung in the opposite direction of, like yourself, a lot of people who have been on the medication successfully for years and then all of a sudden have a rapid taper forced on them, which is in some ways very cruel. And treatment decisions need to be made in a shared decision-making model between the physician and the patient. And each situation is unique and needs to be considered. So I'm happy to hear that you are both on reducing doses, not escalating doses, but also have are back in good shape.
What are some of the drugs that could be used for anxiety over the long term? Maybe you're just an anxious person, and you try exercising, that doesn't do enough. So there are antidepressants, which sort of deal with serotonin levels, and then beta blockers, which can work on adrenaline. But what are the other options that are not detrimental over time?
Well, one thing I see a lot in my practice is people who have a sort of subclinical vitamin B12 deficiency. Sometimes you have nutritional deficiencies that no matter what meds you throw at it, the person is still going to be anxious. So someone can have a vitamin B12 level of 220, and you give them B12, and all of a sudden their anxiety is cured. Vitamin D deficiencies can lead to depression, and that can be a depression with anxious features. So and also thyroid problems. So I always do a medical workup in someone to make sure that we're not missing anything medical. Other medications that can be used for anxiety, some people use gabapentin, which also is a GABAergic medication. As you mentioned, the serotonergic medications, the SSRIs and the SNRIs. I don't use SNRIs as much as a lot of my colleagues. One of them in particular, venlafaxine, has a very serious withdrawal syndrome, so I actually avoid that medication, even though it can be quite useful. But I also get into looking at the cause of the anxiety and some of the belief systems around it, and why is the person anxious? And I use a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy to really look at the automatic thoughts that drive the emotion of the anxiety, and really teaching people to choose a different thought than the automatic thought. And also sometimes people legitimately need to change situations in their life, and the anxiety is really just a marker that something really is wrong here. So I try to take a more integrative approach to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think serotonin reuptake inhibitors or SSRIs like Prozac or Zoloft or things like that, they're really first-line management strategies for anxiety. And really, the most effective treatment for anxiety is actually therapy, psychotherapy. So it depends on what the anxiety syndrome is, but whether it be exposure therapy or EMDR for PTSD-type symptoms, or exposure and response prevention, CBT strategies for OCD, CBT for other anxiety disorders, and even psychodynamic psychotherapy has a really good evidence base for the management of anxiety and panic disorder. They're much more effective. One of the things about benzodiazepines is they're really symptom control. They don't really address the cause of why someone is anxious. And we have anxiety for a variety of reasons. It's a signal that something is not right. Sometimes it can be so elevated that it can cripple us and we're not able to do anything, and that's really where it needs management. But often there's something driving it, and you really need to address that. The first response most people have with anxiety is avoidance, and so you never actually address the problem. And a lot of the psychotherapies really try to encourage or someone to start getting exposed to this thing and realize that it's not, you know, the end of the world.
Are you seeing, we use the word epidemic a lot, so I want to be careful about that, but an increase in anxiety amongst your general patients in society?
I don't think so, but I think we're, you know, one of the nice things about this opioid epidemic and everything else is we're starting to destigmatize mental health and addiction overall. And what that has done is that it has given people more confidence to actually talk about what's actually happening in their life and maybe admitting to some of these symptoms a little more and and seeking treatment for those things. I don't think everything needs a medication to get better. And I do think that our, you know, life now is very different than how life used to be. We have a lot more stresses. Whether it be, and a lot of them are self-imposed, if you think about it. Like, you know, I can get a call at any time now, and I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, it was you really needed a pager to be able to get in contact with someone. So I think life is a bit more stressful in some ways.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Andrucki & King, featuring Judy Andrucki, providing private mediation services in matters of family law. AndruckiLaw.com.
The things you need to live a healthy life, good food, safe housing, transportation, all cost money. And for many people living on disability benefits, money is tight.
But it's going to cost me $15 to go to the doctor. I don't have $15.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The impact of poverty on health in rural America this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. And coming up shortly after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock, it's World Affairs, Cooler Heads in Crisis, Why American Diplomacy Matters Day. Former Deputy Secretary of State Ambassador William Burns discusses effective American leadership in a world of waning American influence abroad. Again, that's coming up at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, benzodiazepines. Joining me, Dr. Allison Molloy, is founder of Portland Cognitive and Behavioral Neurology, and Dr. Jonathan Fellers is with Maine Medical Center. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We did want to mention that there's a special concern around the use of benzodiazepines by older patients. Jonathan, can you explain what that is and why? Sorry, we lost your mic there. Hold on, we'll get it back. Do we have it?
There I am. So I think it's an important point to make. Kind of like the caller had mentioned that he'd been on these medications for 20 years, the risk-benefit ratio may change depending on where someone is and how old they are. I really start worrying about benzodiazepines later on in life. As we kind of get wrinkles, as we get gray hairs, a normal part of aging, there's increased risks with these medications as well. One of the ones that I really worry about is benzodiazepines increase the risk for falls, and that can be a devastating thing for someone. If someone breaks a hip, it could completely change their lifestyle and their quality of life and their actually life expectancy. Cognitive disorders. We know that it does cause antegrade amnesia, as the first caller had said, and cause memory problems, but it has been linked with dementia as well. And so as someone gets older, we really want to avoid anything that is going to impair cognitive function.
One of the challenges is a cultural construct of a lot of the older generation were just prescribed benzos and barbiturates like water, and they've been on these medications for 30 years. So then that creates just an added complication if you get an individual like that, and then you are telling them you want to taper the medications. So it can be very complicated. One of the problems with the backlash against these medications and the often too rapid tapers, like one of the callers alluded to, is that a too rapid taper in an older person has also been shown to cause cognitive problems. So you can maybe follow the books and get someone off a benzo in, you know, the manualized length of time of maybe 2 weeks, but they actually can have cognitive disorder that can last a year. So it's very important to be mindful of the individual. And I think, from my opinion, most of the manualized recommendations for tapering benzodiazepines are way too fast. There's a lot that happens with the taper, and it's not just physiologic, although it's the physiology is important, but it's also psychological and emotional. So I usually take about 3 times the recommended length.
And how long is that?
It depends on the person. It depends on how long they've been on the meds, and also their comorbid anxiety disorders. Yeah.
So we have a question about tapering from Richard in Manchester. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Heroin addict since I was 13. Been on benzos since probably 14 or 15. Was an alcoholic. Currently not using any opiates. My question was about 2-ish years ago, I'm on just for them about 4 milligrams a day, a little slightly more. Is that my, I don't know why he never really explained, but he sort of threatened to do an extremely rapid taper, or said that he could, I should say. Is there anything in the law that where that's cruel and unusual punishment? And also, these benzos did stop me from having seizures due to some TBIs that I had.
Yeah. Okay, Richard. I got shaking head no's to the legal question. I mean, this is about standards of care and then within accepted medical.
Yeah. One of the issues is in an ideal physician-patient relationship, both parties feel comfortable with what is being done. And I have been in a situation many times where a patient wanted something from me that I just personally felt very uncomfortable with, and I encouraged them to seek another physician. I can only practice the medicine that I feel comfortable with, and I'm the first to say that that's not the only way. But people who agree with my style of medicine, then they come to me and they feel satisfied with the care. In the situation that you're describing, it sounds like the physician felt very uncomfortable with the care, and I hope that that would be the motivation rather than a sort of power move or some other dynamic going on. But it sounds like the physician was just uncomfortable with the safety or the quality of the care and didn't want to be providing it per se. So it does get complicated.
Let's go to Marie in Conway, New Hampshire. Hi, Marie. Welcome to the program. Hi, Marie.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. My name's not Marie, but I think I'm the one you wanted to talk to.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's okay. So I'm a little concerned with what feels like the demonization of benzodiazepines. I'm a long-time psychiatric patient. I've availed of myself of several different types of therapy, psychotherapy being one that I use on a consistent basis. I have a huge toolkit for my two diagnoses of depression and anxiety. And I've been on a combination of medications, two medications. One is an SSRI, one's a benzodiazepine. And it's taken my medical team and me years to land upon this. And it's been years since we've landed upon it. And it feels really concerning when things get so black and white that something is taken away from the possibility of something that treats my symptoms that can be incredibly severe so efficiently. So I guess I just ask that we be careful and that we not go the way of, okay, we're never going to prescribe this ever again, because I think that's really misguided. And I want you to know there's a lot of us out here who are on benzodiazepines, who've done everything we were supposed to do and continue to do those things and are stable and are living really full, stable lives. And we don't want to go through the merry-go-round and the topsy-turvy world of trying all these other things that either don't work or the side effects preclude them from being effective. And that's all I wanted to say. So thank you for taking my call.
I'm sorry I got your name wrong.
Yeah, I think the caller makes a great point, and that is the ideal situation. When someone has a involved, attentive medical team and that they try multiple options and get to a treatment that works. And that is one of the risks of the backlash of to benzos brought on by all the talk about the opiate epidemic. It's not really an epidemic. It's been going on for 10 years. It's just now being talked about, as Dr. Fellers mentioned. And there are a lot of rapid tapers, just like the caller before her talked about, you know, that his doctor wanted to do a rapid taper. And I agree. At times, it can be extremely inappropriate.
Let's try to fit in one last call from Jack in Northern Maine. Jack, we only have a minute left, so as quickly as you could, please. But welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I will make this quick. I wanted to get both of your opinions on the impact of the medical marijuana and now recreational marijuana legalization in the state of Maine, and whether or not that has a place at the table in this conversation. And
okay, Jack, we'll ask that question.
What your opinions are.
Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Fellers.
So I see a lot of patients who have medical marijuana cards, and it has been prescribed for anxiety disorders. And I can only really comment on what patients tell me and what the research kind of shows. And there is a discrepancy between those two. So I'm just going to come out and say it, like, even though the patients say that the cannabis has been helpful for their anxiety, and I have heard that consistently from a lot of different patients, the research base doesn't really support that as much, that cannabis overall is not very effective for anxiety disorders. And so there's a discrepancy in the evidence that's out there and the subjective reports of a lot of patients. And I don't know what to make of that. It's just they just don't align.
Yeah. Allison, 30 seconds.
And I think CBD, marijuana in general, is the snake oil of the 21st century. It's now good for everything. And just like any other medication, there needs to be a balanced conversation about the definite pros and the definite cons. And the research, like Dr. Feller said, does not necessarily support using marijuana for anxiety. And when I moved to Maine 7 years ago, I was shocked to learn that the diseases that make their way onto the approved list for medical marijuana are created by lobbies with the legislature. It has nothing to do with the medical literature. One would think that if it's quote-unquote medical marijuana, that the medical community and the research would help inform what disorders got put on that list.
All right. And with that, we're out of time. Interesting conversation. We could go all afternoon. Allison, Jonathan, thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Dr. Allison Molloy is the founder of Portland Cognitive and Behavioral Neurology. Dr. Jonathan Fellers is an addiction psychiatrist at Maine Medical Center. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Ella Boyd answered your calls, and we had additional help from Julie Pike and Eliana Miller. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources, by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast again tonight at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.